Yeah. I played in Poland before I came to the States, Jerry answered. You guys have a movie on this base. How good are you? Jonesy asked. Whoa. Marla pushed next to me on the footlocker. Jonesy, don't tell me I'm going to hear what I think I'm going to hear. Damn straight. Jonesy said. He's here for a week. We can kick some Iraqi butt before he goes. Okay, so we got a dynamite team together. It was me, Jonesy, Marla, and Victor from 2nd Squad, and 3rd Squad with a promise to Pendleton that he could play goalie. Darcy and Evan said they would be our cheerleaders and even Captain Miller said she'd come to see the game. Captain Coles radioed the 422ND and in less than an hour they called back with the news that Omar would set the game up for the next Friday. Jerry was going to teach us the basics and play with us. We need a few thunder kicks, Marla said. Shog and awe, baby. Shog and awe. We set up a practice area and started assigning positions. There were defenders, forwards, centers, the whole works. Soccer was a lot more complicated than I thought it was. The bad part was moving the ball. If you stopped to kick it, somebody was on top of you and it didn't go in the direction you wanted it to go. If you tried to kick it while it was moving, it might go anywhere. You gotta concentrate, Jerry said. I could see the frustration on his face the first day, especially when a few of us missed the ball entirely. And any time Jerry wanted to come over and take the ball from us, he could. He could just work his feet better than we could. Finally, he stopped us from trying to move the ball up and down the field and just put us in a circle and had us kick it around to one another. By the third day we were almost getting it. Victor was pretty good, and so was Ahmed. You're not bad, Perry, Jerry said to me. Somewhere between Ronaldinho's grandmother and my dog. Yeah, thanks. I thought we were getting it. We could actually pass the ball to one another and, as long as Jerry wasn't too close, move it some. The week had been slow. The 422ND was moving into Baghdad and taking over the big stuff. They were trying to get a hospital and a school up and running on the edge of the old city. Our guys were mostly playing cards and watching television and staying out of the heat. Nobody was anxious to go out of what they were now calling the green zone. There had been some nasty incidents in town. An IED had gone off near a marine vehicle, but no one was seriously hurt. It turned into pretty nasty business when some Iraqi men started cheering and the Marines opened up on them. One of them was wounded pretty badly and lay in the street for a half an hour before a Red Crescent ambulance picked him up. A newsman asked some of the guys what they thought about the incident and they all shrugged him off. Later, in the tent, we talked about it again. Man, you got to be kidding, Jonesy said, pulling at his crotch the way he did when he was mad. Don't be smiling and showing your teeth when some sucker is trying to shoot me. You might as well be doing the shooting yourself as far as I'm concerned. The row for Baghdad says you don't shoot anybody unless they're clearly engaged in trying to harm you, Pendleton said. That's not true, Pendleton, I said. The word this morning was that we're authorized to shoot looters. That's not right. Pendleton was shaking his head. That's just not right. Yo, man, come here for a minute, Jonesy leaned forward and whispered to Pendleton, who didn't move. You take those rules of engagement and pin them over your butt and see if one of these dudes running around with a tablecloth on his head don't shoot you through it. Jonesy was right. The rules counted only for us. The Iraqis who were out to get us could do anything they wanted. We got clearance in the morning of the game and were rolling toward Al-Uhaymira by 1,000 hours. Captain Miller and Jerry rode with 2nd Squad. We took along 3 extra balls for the kids and some notebooks and pencils. For the first time in a long, long time I felt really human. I hadn't been down or anything. Just tired all the time. Sleep didn't count in Iraq the way it did at home. I always woke up tired. We got to the village and the first kid I see is Omar. He's there and he's got a soccer ball under his arm. There were a batch of guys from the 422ND, some officers, and a photography crew too. Somebody had leaked the game. Man, you guys are going to be on CNN tonight, Marla said. Maybe Captain Miller and I should strip down to our shorts and shake our booties for the camera. Captain Miller, who was in a surprisingly good mood, raised an eyebrow. We met the Iraqi kids. Only they weren't the same kids we had played the first game with. These guys were older, teenagers. Hey, Bertie, you getting a bad feeling about this game? Captain Coles asked. Yep. I got Omar by the sleeve and asked him what was up with all of the new guys. People from three villages wanted to play, he said, holding up three fingers. They all know about the game and want to play against the Americans. Who told them? He grinned and stuck his chest out. We wore sneakers and shorts. The Iraqis, for the most part, were barefoot in jalabas. Two had on regular pants and one was wearing sneakers. It was a bloodbath. We were competitive for about 3 minutes. Then they figured out that Jerry was our only real player and kept the ball away from him. The Iraqis had 6 shots on goal before we had one. They only made 4. The score was 12-0 before we had to stop it while they argued among themselves. They were yelling at Omar pretty hard and I think he wanted them to have mercy on us. They brought in 2 more players, teenagers again, and ran the score up to 20-0. Then Omar got the teenagers to sit out and got some really young kids in to play against us. By that time we were all standing with our tongues out and our hands on our knees and Captain Miller was warning us about dehydration. Meanwhile the camera crew was having a field day, running up and down the field preserving our humiliation for all time. I make a motion we should come back and shoot them, Victor said as we lay on the ground afterward. We voted on the motion and it passed, 9-0. The 422 ND served up some lunch and the film crew took pictures of some of the Iraqis and some officers. Miller wouldn't let them take her picture. Tribe loyalty, she said. That was cool. Omar and 3 of his friends ate lunch with us. Omar, what would you do if you came to America? Marla asked. I would go to New York City and see the tall buildings, Omar said. And I would go to college and play a horn. He made a movement as if he were playing a trombone. Do you play trombone? Coles asked. No. But I would learn in college, he said. How did you learn to play football so well? Miller had been writing down the ingredients on an MRE package. I don't play so well, but I am Islam, so I win. He reached over and touched each of his friends on the chest. Islam, Islam, Islam. And we aren't Islam so we don't win? I asked. Omar touched each of us. Infidel, infidel, infidel. Infidel, infidel, infidel. He had to get up and walk around the table to get to me and Pendleton, and he did. We need us a little old grandmother to sit out on the porch and let us know what the real deal is. Pendleton's drawl had gotten thicker. This morning they were talking about how this thing is almost over and by noon we were hearing that a bunch of special ops guys got nailed up at Nazaria. That was supposed to be friendly fire, Jonesy said. I don't know why they're calling it friendly fire if it kills you, Pendleton said. A jet wasted a truckload of guys. I thought those pilots had to have clearance before they shot. Anything on the ground? Victor was hanging out more with First Squad. He was sharpening the huge knife he carried all the time. How are they going to communicate with our people jamming their radio frequencies? Jonesy asked. That's what they were doing last Sunday. Jamming the frequencies so the Iraqis couldn't set off their IEDs by cell phone. You couldn't communicate from the top of your bunk to the bottom last Sunday. If Marla and RC were in here begging for some action by radio you wouldn't even know it. You guys sweating those chicks when you should be sweating getting home in one piece, Victor said. Hey, Victor, who you going to attack with that knife when you got your 16 grenades and a mouthful of teeth to fight with? Jonesy asked. This knife makes me feel good, Victor said. I'm thinking, suppose it's just me and Pablo in a dark room. He's scared and I'm scared. I hear him breathing, you know, slow-like. Then I move toward him and he's listening and thinking and getting into position for some hand-to-hand. Then UNNH. UNNH. He feels some cold steel going into his side and he don't know what's happening. UNNH. UNNH. Then he knows but it's too late. You saw that in the movies? I asked. No, man, in a drained-out water canal in Albuquerque. So what are we going to do about the radios? Jonesy said. The radios were a problem because the bad guys were wiring their bomb detonators between the phone and the ringtone device. They would wait for a convoy to come along, then call the number. Instead of ringing, it would detonate the bomb. Countermeasures could block their signals, but it was messing with our radio communications. Operation Iraqi Freedom had started off with all of the high-tech stuff being on our side, but now the insurgents, as they were being called, were doing some low-tech stuff that was just enough to kill or hurt somebody every day. When the God Squad came over, Chaplain Nichols and his bodyguard started talking about how proud the folks back home were of us. Captain Coles asked Nichols point-blank what he thought the folks back home knew. They know that the same American army that put itself in harm's way for the sake of democracy is also building fresh water wells and giving shots to the children in Iraq, the chaplain said. They know that even though there are casualties and deaths, there's also a spirit among the men and women over here that wants to help the Iraqis build freedom. Is any of that not true? I just wondered if they knew how many people are getting wounded here, Cole said. I don't see any of that in the news at night. That's because we're still in a war zone, the chaplain answered. Do we really want to broadcast everything we know? All of that was true. A directive had even come down from CENTCOM about what we could put in our emails. I could see that. The more information our guys put online, the more the bad guys would know and use against us. On the other hand, the more they clamped down on bad news, the more rumors went around. Everybody was edgy and nobody wanted to leave the green zone until they couldn't stand the closeness anymore. But even in the zone, we couldn't shake how randomly things were going down. Just the way we are playing poker here and looking to see what hand we get, that's the way this war is going down, Sergeant Harris said, looking at his cards. I've got two pair, jacks over eights, Marla said, throwing $2 into the pot. So it's going pretty good for me. Yeah, but the next hand you might get nothing, Harris said. That's what I'm talking about. You never can tell what's going to come up. Everybody folded and Marla scooped up the money and laid her cards on the table. Hey, you don't have any jacks over eights, Harris said. No, but you folded, so I got the money, Marla said. What makes it so random is that we're fighting on three levels. Lieutenant Colonel Petridis was from PSYOP. A tall guy, he played poker wearing a cowboy hat and chewing on a skinny cigar that wiggled up and down when he talked. There are the big guys in the back with the money and their plans for this country. They're the ones we need to kill, but we'll never see them because they're too far underground or maybe not even in this country. Then there are the people who hate everything American, everything Western, and want to go back to a religious world that never existed in the first place. The last level is all about people who don't have jobs and will plant an IED or take their chances shooting at us because they need the money. And since the big people, the players behind the scene, just want to keep the chaos going until they see a chance to step in, they don't care who they kill. Not really. They'd kill each other as fast as they kill us. Whose deal is it? It's my deal, I said, picking up the cards. Yo, sir, this sounds like a crack house operation, Jonesy said. Not that I know anything about crack houses. Just about, the PSYOP guy said. You think the people in Washington have it all figured out? I asked. If they don't, maybe we should send them a telegram. I once played in a poker game in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, Lieutenant Colonel Petridis said. I had a real lucky night and the little girl I was going to marry, I'm still married to her, was sitting there admiring me all the time. But the guy who ran the game was taking 5% of every pot. At the end of the night I was the big winner and went home stone broke. Think about it. It wasn't what I wanted to hear. I also lost $30. Captain Coles was down because his wife had written and said that his 3-year-old had been hospitalized. How's she doing? I asked. They don't know, he said. You got a bunch of doctors in a university hospital and they don't know what's wrong with her. All they know is that she's having a reaction from the vaccination she had to have so she wouldn't get sick. I tried to think of something to say, but couldn't. It didn't seem fair, in a way, that everything back in the real world was still going on while we were in Iraq. Coles was worried about his kids, and wishing he could be there for them. I remembered Pendleton showing pictures of his daughters around. I hadn't looked at them when he did. The next time he brought them out, I would. We turned on the television and watched cartoons for the rest of the afternoon. After about 3 hours of watching, we decided to map out a plan for Wile E. Coyote to finally trap the Roadrunner. We need a trap that's activated by the beep beep, Marla said. Rooney, one of the construction guys, said that one could be built. All they needed was the specs. Marla, two of the construction guys, Toby Corbin, and somebody they got on the phone from Countermeasures drew up the specs to send to the Acme Corporation. They were going to send for a Burmese tiger trap, a Burmese tiger, a Roadrunner costume and makeup kit, and a beep beep audio trigger. So while E. Coyote can dress the tiger up in the Roadrunner costume and make it look like a foxy Roadrunner. Then he puts him in the tiger trap, Marla said. When the Roadrunner comes along and sees her, he goes into the trap and says beep beep and the trap closes and the Roadrunner is in the cage with the tiger, who then eats him. It was a perfect plan and we spent over an hour in figuring out how the Roadrunner was going to get away. Then we watched a show in which some woman was trying to figure out who the father of her baby was and we took bets if the guy she named was the father or not. I won $3 by being the only one who didn't think the dude was the baby's father. I went to the sleeping area and had just pulled off my boots when Jonesy came in. We're going out again, he said. Where to? I asked. North on Highway 4, Jonesy said. Crap. Highway 4 ran through some of the worst territory for ambushes in Iraq. The 2nd Infantry had spent days fighting house to house clearing terrorists from the small towns in the area. But as soon as they left, the terrorists would move back in. It's supposed to be safe now, Jonesy said. And the Iraqis are taking the area over. We're going up there to give them a big hand, or hand over the keys, or something. I got my boots back on, grabbed my gear, and went out to where the guys were already in a kind of huddle. They had all been bored 20 minutes before, but nobody wanted to leave the zone. What are we going to be doing? Marla asked. Showing support for the Iraqi police, Cole said. You can't get us out of any of this crap? Marla looked disgusted. Kennedy, do you know what insubordination is? Cole asked. Yeah. That's when you mouth off and they put you in some safe stockade so you don't get killed, Marla said. The Iraqi police trainees are taking over security for that water project near Bukuba, Captain Cole said. We're going to escort them and show our pretty faces for a camera op. I thought that water project was civilian, I said. It is, but we want to show that the Iraqis are taking over their own country and running as many operations as possible. Captain Cole said as he checked his ammo pouches. We're doing the official show today and they're actually going to take it over next week. How come the 3RD doesn't make a presence? Jonesy asked. We were all glad to see the Iraqis take over security and anything else they wanted to take over. The more Iraqis on the line, the less chance we had of getting hurt or killed. The 3RD guys were training the Iraqis and said that most of them weren't interested in what they were doing. They need the jobs, though. That was good enough for me. We mounted up with all three squads and two ugly but Striker vehicles that were around to be up armored. The Strikers looked like toy tanks that had grown too fast. They had conventional tires instead of tracks. They could carry a whole infantry squad into battle, but the guys had to come out the back when they let the ramp down. I wouldn't want to be cramped into that dark tin can interior and then have to come out into the daylight looking around to see who's trying to kill me. Word was the Strikers could be knocked out with an RPG or a single grenade into the tire well. The army had put a steel grid on the front and sides of most of them. The theory was that if they got it by an RPG, the rocket would go off before it actually hit the body of the vehicle. The Iraqis saw that and started shooting two RPGs at the same time. The first would blow away the steel cage and the second would microwave the guys inside the Striker. We were supposed to convoy up to Bukuba escorting a busload of Iraqi policemen and a bus of PR guys. There would be a ceremony, and then we would all come back to the green zone, except for the Iraqis, who would go back to their training barracks. We found out that there were only two guys in each of the two Striker vehicles. A driver and the vehicle commander. It was all show and tell. We had our three Humvees and the Iraqi trainees were in a bus. Probably air-conditioned, Marla said. You can ride with them if you want, Captain Cole said. One of the strikers led the convoy and the other one was on the tail end. Harris took his Humvee into the two slot. Third squad was next, then the two buses, then us and the other striker. We got held up while they tried to round up some more news guys for the PR bus. With the buses it took 40 minutes, with all of us sweating and grumbling, to get to the place they were going to have the ceremony. I had got an infection of some kind between my legs. It felt like jock itch, and the bouncing around in the Humvee chafed it more. Technically, it was Bukuba, I guess, but just on the outskirts of the city. Good. The company that was working on extending the freshwater lines had hired private guards, a lot of ex-special ops guys, some good old boys from stateside police departments, and just some dudes who didn't mind killing people. They'd dress like they had all just come out of central casting, sunglasses, bandanas, beards, earrings, and scowls. What they really have going for them is no row cards, Captain Cole said. The Iraqis knew that the private guys did not have rules of engagement cards and didn't care who they shot. If you weren't wearing a standard coalition uniform, you were fair game. The media people got out of the bus and I saw that Sessions was with them. They set up a table with a white tablecloth and laid out some food. Then they had the Iraqi trainees line up outside of the bus, do a little marching around, and get their pictures taken. It was cool for our guys to put down the Iraqi soldiers, but I liked them. Better than that, their taking over the operations made a lot of sense to me. We hung for an hour while the Iraqis ran through some drills for the cameras. I could tell that the official press guys weren't that interested, but they took lots of photographs, anyway. Stock footage, one of the cameramen said. They have huge vaults of this kind of stuff in case they need it as background for a real story. Are you saying this isn't a real war? Captain Cole asked. Not this part of it, the cameraman said. This is about as real as Little Red Riding Hood. I saw Harris running his mouth with the three RDID guys and reminded myself that I didn't like him. He had even come over to Jonesy and made some crack about how lame the Iraqi trainees looked. Jonesy had ignored his remarks. I could tell Jonesy was tense when Harris was talking to him. Captain Coles went to the PR bus and copped some sandwiches and brought them back. Sessions checked to see if we could split and got the okay. We mounted up to go back to the zone and I could see that there was some beer being passed around in the PR bus. Coles must have seen it too. It's probably warm, he said. The mood lightened and we started singing Survivor. We had left Yusarian back at the base because we were afraid of running into brass, but we sang his theme song, anyway. We were making good time, looping northwest to take a different route, when Marla announced a roadblock a quarter of a mile ahead of us. Looks like a bus broken down at the intersection, she said. Don't bunch up, Captain Cole said, trying to look out of the side window. Jonesy had already stopped and had moved the Humvee to the right. The striker behind us stopped and the driver popped out and ran up to us. You guys got any cigarettes? The kid didn't look old enough to smoke. Nobody in this squad smokes, Marla said. Check out the film crews. We looked down the line and saw the Iraqis getting out of their bus and waiting by the side of the road. Marla said they were probably waiting for the film crew to set up before they pushed the bus off the road. Sure enough, a moment later some guys from the PR bus got off. One carried what looked like a camera. Ahead of us Darcy was climbing out of the turret and I watched her go off toward the side of the road. When she unrolled her poncho and started wrapping it around her waist I had to laugh. She was going to take a leak. Yo, Jonesy, check out what Darcy's doing. I had my head turned when the bus exploded. The impact went through my body and slammed me against the back of the Humvee. My rifle was between my legs, the butt on the floor. By the time I got it up and pointed out of the window, the second explosion went off. Daisy chain. Jonesy threw the Humvee into reverse and started backing up toward the striker. The guys in the striker didn't know what was happening. They figured it out when Jonesy screeched by them. Look for bandits. Look for bandits. Coles was yelling. Darcy, get in. Marla was screaming even though Darcy was way too far away to hear her. I saw Darcy dive through the side window as 3rd Squad's Humvee started backing toward us. Ta-ta chow. Ta-ta chow. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-chow. The harsh chatter of the M240 filled the cab of the Humvee and damn near sent me into a panic. Where? Where? Jonesy searched both sides of the road. I don't know, Marla said. But there's a ridge over there. Ceasefire. Ceasefire. Captain Coles's voice was calmer than ours. Then it went into panic mode as 2 heads came up over the ridge. Fire. Fire. Marla opened up again and the heads ducked down. Up ahead of us, Darcy was back up in the Humvee, the poncho still tied around her waist. The guys from the Striker were out and racing toward the ridge. 3rd Squad had the same idea and moved toward it too. There had already been 2 explosions and I was hoping there wouldn't be a 3rd. The Striker guys were spread out as they went over the ridge. I saw them stand, fire some short bursts, then lower their weapons. As quickly as it had started, the attack was over. Check out the damage up ahead. Don't get jumpy, Cole said. I looked down at my finger, which was wrapped tightly around the trigger, but the safety was still on. I brought the muzzle of the 16 up and sniffed it. Crap. I hadn't fired a shot. I was squeezing a lock trigger. The buzz had been the main blast. The Striker had been in a direct line and the blast had tipped it over on its side. The Striker's front was crushed on one side, the side that was off the ground. The driver was hurt bad. 2 of the cameramen were slightly wounded. One had an ugly scrape on his head, more blood than depth. The other wasn't hurt at all. Inside the PR bus they had been scattered, but no one had been hurt too badly. They set off the bus and daisy-chained IEDs along the road, but most of them didn't go off, an infantry officer was saying. We were lucky. 3rd Squad's Humvee was off the road and Evans pulled up to them. At first I thought they had just driven off the road to guard the flank. But Evans signaled us over. I'll check it out, I said, sliding out of the Humvee. Watch yourself, Marla said. The front of 3rd Squad's Humvee looked fine. I looked in the cabin and saw Sergeant Love, his forehead down on the dashboard, his body shaking. Pendleton lay next to him. There was a huge wound in the side of his neck. Victor was on turret and had been hit through the windows. One hand and both of his legs were bloody. We lifted him from the top and led him down the side of the Humvee. I've called for medevacs, Major Sessions said. The side of her face was swollen where she had slammed into something. How are the squads? It took a while to get Pendleton's door open. I couldn't help myself when I started to cry. I couldn't help myself when the door opened and we unbuckled him and let the weight of his big body fall against our chests. We got him on the ground and felt around for a pulse. You never can tell, Cole started. You never can tell. You could tell. 2 ALOS flew overhead and circled us, looking for bad guys. The first medevac chopper came and took Victor and Jonesy, who had a piece of shrapnel cut through his chin, and the 2 PR guys. A 3 RDID company rolled up and deployed around us. The next medevac took a cameraman and Pendleton. I felt pressed by a huge weight, like every bad minute you had ever had in your life had come back and was inside your chest and just sitting there. It was like having a huge vulture eat at your stomach and being too tired to do anything about it. I couldn't stop crying as we made our way back through the streets of Baghdad to the green zone. Stay alert, Cole said. No. I heard myself say the word. I wasn't sure if it was loud enough for anyone else to heed. I didn't want to be alert anymore. I didn't want to be a good soldier. I just wanted to shut down this whole damn war. Stay alert, Cole said again. I straightened up and focused on the low rooftops, barely visible through the dust rising from the vehicles ahead. I wiped my sweaty palm on my pants leg and gripped the stock of the weapon in my lap. Back in the zone, Major Sessions got us together in the officer's tent. Her face was swollen badly. One eye was shut and she couldn't talk clearly. Captain Miller was there, trying to get Sessions to lie down. We'll have a memorial service this Sunday, Sessions said. She was crying too. I was glad to see her tears. I wanted the whole world to feel the pain. We went back to the quarters and guys started asking us what had happened. We just told them that Pendleton was dead and that we would let them know the rest in the morning. I was lying across the bed when Marla came in. I just figured it out, she said. Her face was twitching in anger. Somebody knew all the damn details. Somebody knew all the damn details and passed it on. When we thought of it, we realized that she was right. The insurgents had had time to set up the IEDs along the road, waiting for our convoy. We had taken a different road out than the one we had taken going in, but still they were waiting for us. Somebody had called them. Had given them a route. Later, as I lay in the darkness, I thought about Pendleton's two little girls. How he had talked about sending them to college. I hadn't even looked at their pictures when he was showing them around. Oh, God, why hadn't I looked at the pictures? The memorial for Pendleton was held 2 days after we watched a plane lift off with his remains from Baghdad Airport. Earlier that morning we had received word that Saddam's two sons had been killed in a firefight. Reporters were running around shoving mics into faces and getting the responses they expected. Al Jazeera was trying to spice up their stories with talk about whether the sons' bodies should have been displayed. They're trying to play it down the middle. Evans was sipping from a plastic cup of coffee. I bet they're coming off a lot different when they're talking to the Arabs. What was the right way to report a war? A neat list of names in a hometown newspaper? Maybe your picture in the New York Times. That was all that mattered. Nothing was ever settled. It was just who was dying and who was coming home. Darcy showed up with her plastic mug full of coffee. She sat at the end of the table and cupped it in her hands. She was still standoffish, but drawing closer. Coles came a bit later and told us that Jonesy was back with a puffy chin, but Victor couldn't make it. He wanted to come, but they ordered him onto the plane for the hospital in Ramstein, Coles said. They think they can save two of his fingers. They can definitely save the thumb. That's good. That's good. I imagine Victor on the streets back home. Would the streets be less hard because he had lost two fingers? The memorial was in front of the tent we were using for a chapel. We lined up in four rows. First, second, and third squads were in the first row, with other CA squads behind us. Some guys from the 3RD were there too. Miller was crying. So was Jonesy. The ceremony was brief. Pendleton's boots, M16, and Kevlar were on the small altar. We stood for the national anthem. He asked if anybody wanted to say anything about Pendleton. No one did. No one really knew him that much. Finally, Cole stepped forward and took a paper from his pocket. Lord, have mercy on us as we feel the pain of loss, and the endless emptiness that marks the passing of Corporal Pendleton. And have mercy on us as we feel sorrow for ourselves, and for all the angel warriors for whom we feel kinship. Let us fear death, but let it not dwell within us. Protect us, O Lord, and be merciful unto us. Amen. The chaplain spoke of the need to move on, that those who find strength in the Lord would renew their strength and mount up with wings as eagles. They would run and not be weary. They would walk and not faint. I felt like fainting. Roll call, officer. Major Sessions stepped forward. She lifted her clipboard, glanced down at it and quickly up again. Pendleton. She called out. The moment of silence was crushing. Corporal Philip Pendleton. Another moment of silence. And then the mournful sound of the bugle sounding taps filled the tent. The final roll call for Pendleton was completed. Two soldiers took his medals and laid them in front of his weapons. The ceremony was over. We drifted away from the tent and went about the business of trying to walk and talk among the living. The day began badly. The smell from the river drifted over us like the stink of doom. Nothing was right. I tried to push the vision of Pendleton out of my head, but it was impossible. Who was he? Why didn't I know more about him? Why didn't I sit with him and talk to him and try to understand what made him who he was? Let's go find Marla, Jonesy said. We found her in the corner of the day room in front of the television. There was a game show on, but I knew she wasn't really watching it. You okay? I asked her. No, she said. May 29, 2003. Hey mom. Go on with your head self getting online. I'm really proud of you. I know you go down to the County Calling branch with Mrs. Lucas to use their computers, but be careful at night. Okay, so first thing, thank you for the dolls. Everybody in the church must have donated one. We gave them out to girls just north of the Green Town, the safe zone here. And, just as you said in your letter, the little Arab girls really went for the black dolls. These little Iraqi girls are very sweet. Please thank everybody from the church for me. Jonesy is taking some pictures and I'll get some printed up for you as soon as I can. If we weren't at war with these people, this would be a great place to spend some time. You would really be impressed by the mosques. If you saw the one up at Qasimain, it would take your breath away. Second thing, the women in Iraq mostly don't wear veils. They dress like ordinary business people. Sometimes you see women in veils, but they're often from another part of the Middle East. They do cover their hair and mostly don't wear makeup. In a video store, they sell tapes of belly dancers, and every guy over here has at least one tape. Except me, of course, since I'm not interested in wriggling ladies. Okay, maybe just not wriggling Iraqi ladies. Did you know they also have Christians over here in the Christian church? According to the locals, it's no big deal. I can't always get online, but now that you're on, I'll try to find an in and email you as much as possible. Much love to you and Pops. Robin.